I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast. I felt that was extra chirpy this week. I've decided, Stephen, that as it's half term, what we should do this week, also because if I have to talk about Europe again, I will die, that we should give half term awards as a way of probably getting to be quite mean about a lot of politicians in a very short space of time.
Yeah, I'm all for that.
So let's give out some grades. David Cameron.
I've got to give him a C. So, you know, he hasn't, you know, he's done enough. Yeah, I'm not saying we should keep, he's coming back next term, regrettably, for more fun. But obviously, the European renegotiation is a horror show from start to finish.
Is it, though? Because I know he's not getting anything and everybody's grumpy about it, but does it matter? Is any,
I think it sort of depends. So, I mean, perhaps I'm putting him in a no-win situation here, but so there are two scenarios with the emergency break, which is obviously this idea for listeners just joining us. And then you will take away benefits for you'll taper benefits for 4 years, and this will stop migrants coming to the United Kingdom from the euro area. Of course, the reason why people come from the European Union to Britain is because of the British jobs market is in better health than
and also because our jobs here are still better paid, even if you with no in-work benefits, than they would be in Eastern European countries.
Yeah, the FD had a really good stat. And if you are working in a McDonald's in Poland, you can't afford one Big Mac with an hour's wages. Whereas if you are working at a McDonald's in London, you can afford 2.6.
Shouldn't do that for an 8-hour shift, though. That would be bad.
No, but, you know, so that is so the idea that the benefits cut, you know, it's cruel, but it doesn't deter people.
And same
from,
with child benefit. Yeah. The vast majority of migrants come over for a couple of years and they are disproportionately young and single and child-free.
So my fear is that, there are two things. At the time of recording, there's still a decent chance that he won't get anything because he spent a year wooing Angela Merkel, whereas your Poland, the Czech Republic, these nations, their leaders and diplomats basically feel that Cameron has spent 3 years talking about them, not to them. So there's still a chance he ends up with nothing, even if he gets what he wants. If we go into the referendum and the Inn is having to say, look, this will stop migration, well, every academic, every economist, and for the first time, every tabloid newspaper will stop saying, oh, benefits draw migrants. Although this isn't going to do a thing to stop migration. So it's a very risky place to put it on. But you know, I'm giving him a C because...
I think I'd give him a slightly better one because I feel like, well, I don't know. It's all been sacrificed about managing party discipline, hasn't it? And I guess it's whether or not you think, actually, if he'd been slightly bolder and gone, will you all just shut up? But I think what this has done is called the bluff of a lot of allegedly Eurosceptic Tory MPs, particularly senior Tories, who have, you know, mouthed off about evil Europe and are now going to have to slightly recalibrate the language. Talking of which, Theresa May.
Oh, Theresa May. You've got to give her a D, actually, because, one, it's been a fairly terrible, so I'm going to also cheat and give my grade to George Osborne at the same time.
Yeah.
You've got to give Osborne an F grade. Failed every target he set himself. The unravelling of his reputation as a master strategist. You know, he's kind of gone from Blofeld to Dr. Evil in the course of...
Yes, tax credits hit him pretty hard, as did... as did his chances of the next Tory leader. I just feel like there's been a sort of move among MPs where they're just a bit sort of sullen about the prospect now.
Yeah, there's this feeling, whenever I talk to someone else, so one said, oh, we know the Chancellor has a bye to the final. And there's this assumption of, oh, well, we know that he will be in the top two. But there's
increasingly
small enthusiasm for him. A lot of uncertainty. That should really have been the moment for Theresa May, the most senior woman in the government. She really ought to be moving into pole position, but...
what I keep hearing is that, you know, there are no Mayites. There's no sort of parliamentary base for her. And because of the way that the Tory contest works, you know, with MPs having to put forward two candidates to the wider membership, you really have to be wooing those MPs' heart. Which brings us to Boris Johnson. So there's been a whole lot of chat about how there was a newspaper report saying, you know, George Osborne has been having people over for lovely Chardonnay in his staterooms. Boris Johnson has been getting MPs in for a, you know, takeaway curry eaten out of tinfoil. I am going to give Boris Johnson a U. Yeah. How do you like them apples? Well, I'm just tired a bit, Stephen. I'm fed up. You know, all this stuff about it, whether or which way he's going to go, is become, frankly, pretty tedious. And become a kind of, why has this turned into the Boris Johnson show? And also, I'm just feeling like he's not been a great London mayor. And also, he's still London mayor. Why isn't he doing a bit more bloody mayoring? The Garden Bridge is sucking up all this huge amount of taxpayers' money at the same time that other, you know, Ian Jack read a piece in The Guardian about the fact that five northern museums are being shut down, whereas we're getting some pot plants on a steel strut that will be closed overnight and closed for corporate parties. I just don't see the point. And London has got some really serious problems. Like, housing is only the most obvious of them. And, you know, transport is another obvious one. The mayor has got seriously big powers, but he's totally checked out. Like, he's done that. That was the boost he needed to build himself a base somewhere else. He's now parlayed that back into Parliament. But so he's sort of, you know, YOLO.
I put it to you that I prefer a switched-off Boris Johnson, because last time Boris switched on to the problems of London, he commissioned a bus which is bespoke, is dangerous on hot days. We're never going to be able to sell it to anyone, and it has a capacity of about 8, and is really bad for disabled passengers. Boris not caring about London, I think, has been great for considering the options, which is a Boris Johnson who cares about London and builds a new route master, and a Boris Johnson who doesn't care about London. And also the cable car.
The cable car.
I actually used to be one of the 5 passengers of the cable car.
When I used to live in Surrey Quays and work on weekends in Kensington, I was sometimes, the Circle Line would be closed, and I would get the boat. The boat was great. The boat was obviously only got you as far as Embankment. They had Smirnoff Ice on the boat.
Wow.
Yeah. Blimey. It's pretty exciting coming home on the boat after a shift. Yeah.
Yeah, there was no alcohol on the cable car.
You could bring your own alcohol. Oh, I know, because you can't have open alcohol now, can you? Yeah. Presumably the Smirnoff Ice has also been turned off on the boat now that it's more integrated into TfL. Listeners, if you do know about the availability of Smirnoff Ice on London's public transport, I am interested.
Other grades. I think for me, the dunce of the year has got to be Chris Grayling.
Oh, yes. Can we have a go? Well, Ian Duncan Smith.
Ian Duncan Smith, it almost feels...
He hasn't got appreciably worse. I guess that's the point, isn't he?
He's managed to achieve this zen level of incompetence where I just kind of take... People are like, Ian Duncan Smith is awful. It's like, oh yeah, Ian Duncan Smith is awful, but...
There was a tweet today from the guy who's heading up Universal Credit being like, Universal Credit's still going great. We've got 170,000 people on it. And you're like, well, that is in some ways good. It's not the 4 million you were promising by now, is it though? But yeah, no, Chris Grayling is related to my grade for Michael Gove. And this is going to upset, and I'm pleased teachers send hate mail to the New Statesman office. I'm going to give Michael Gove an A-.
Yeah, I think he's been a brilliant Shadow Justice Secretary. I was talking to someone from the Shadow Justice team, and they said, the real difficulty with Michael Gove is it's really hard for us not to look churlish, because you just sit there going, we're really glad you've done this thing that we told you to do last year, and there's really nothing else you can say other than go...
No, but he scrapped the courts charge, which was this unfair kind of penalty that really was an incentive for poor people to plead guilty, you know, because it was levied on top of any fines and any legal fees. He's cancelled that 5.9 million contract with the Saudis to provide whatever the sinister metaphor was about support and access training. And he's wholeheartedly scrapped Chris Grayling's legal aid reforms because there were 90 legal challenges. I mean, the one thing that lawyers are notoriously really good at is mounting legal challenges to things they don't like.
And prison.
And that's why I give him the minus, okay? Because the big problem in prisons because I interviewed for the Week of Westminster, Francis Crook of the Howard League, is just overcrowded. There are 85,000 people in prisons. It's double what there were when Margaret Thatcher left office. There is one suicide in prison every 4 days. And a lot of those problems are down to overcrowding. So Michael Gove's got a plan, which is that he's going to sell off and demolish the old Victorian city centre prisons, move them out to the countryside. In one sense, great, have more space. In another sense, that's, I worry about the fact that, particularly for the women's prison in Holloway, it's good for people to be integrated into the community. It's good for their families to be able to come and visit them. And one of the things that's really unpleasant about Yarl's Wood, the detention centre, is the fact that it's a miles down the end of pretty much an unlit lane. If that's the way to fund better prison by selling off, prime slices of London real estate, and that's the only way you're going to get that money in an austerity government, maybe it's a pragmatic solution.
And also, he is now saying, the only, other than Ken Clark, who didn't really count, because by that point he'd basically checked out of the government, the first person to go, prison doesn't work. And actually it's mainly a university of crime. So, yeah, I'm going to give him an A. So,
this is it. Every teacher is we're dead to them. Who else? Who else have we forgotten?
Nicky Morgan, of course.
Don't mind Nicky Morgan. Hasn't really done a lot of late that I've heard about.
I was tempted to give her a B for boring, as it were.
Jeremy Hunt gets a bad grade. If you're a Tory health minister, you have a really difficult position anyway, because people just do not trust the Conservatives on the NHS. The BMA are the union that no one really knows is a trade union. People really like doctors. They really trust them because doctors are magic people who tell you what the rash is and make sure that you don't die of it. You use the NHS when, your baby stops breathing. That makes, obviously, that inculcates far greater gratitude than, the concept of some health secretary sitting somewhere. Nonetheless, I just think he's sort of turning into Ed the Duck in my mind. I just don't know. His hair's got sort of kind of fluffier. And I just don't know.
He also is giving off a hapless air.
Yes, that's the Ed the Duck thing. I just think he just doesn't seem authoritative. He just seems somebody who's slightly panicked. As indeed he might be.
Yeah, as I would be too if I managed to upset quite that many medical professionals. But yeah, and so obviously he's failed from a political perspective, and his job was kind of to avoid fires going off in the DOH. He's failed from a policy perspective in that there is the real chance he is going to be the recruiting sergeant for Australian and New Zealand medicalness.
And, medicalness.
I can't really think of a third way he's failed, but I like lists of three, so I'm kind of stuffed.
Yeah, well, he didn't go out and defend the policy very much, did he? I mean, I know John Snow moaned that he hadn't been on Channel 4 News since May 2013, and then he sort of tipped up that weekend. But that's always a difficult calibration for a cabinet minister to make. How much do you go out there and really get associated with your really unpopular policies? But versus, if you don't bother to defend them, you just let someone else dictate all the coverage about them. Have we forgotten any? Oh, Michael Fallon. Michael Fallon, I briefly warmed to after we were both on the MAR programme, and I had quite an interesting discussion with him, which he impressed me as being more serious than I'd hitherto said. But I just saw a Guardian headline on the front page just before we came up here saying, Michael Fallon, Jeremy Corbyn is more dangerous to the Falklands than Argentina.
I mean,
and I thought, do you know what? Jeremy Corbyn has notoriously got a warship. That is true. Do you know who we've forgotten? And I think this sort of speaks to the grade that he's going to get. Philip Hammond.
I mean, surely he's like a did not compete, really. I mean, he's just being like...
Well, I guess the problem has been that the big subject is Europe. And he's just not on the pitch because Cameron wants to handle the renegotiation himself, So everything that is now Europe adjacent, things like, migration, for example, even things like sort of NATO and UN stuff about refugee movements... has all been sort of sucked. I mean, Cameron has sort of gone a bit presidential, hasn't he, this term?
Well, all prime ministers become their own foreign secretaries eventually. I can't remember who said that, but I'm sure they were someone very wise. Or maybe I said it, who knows? But that's kind of the problem for him, exactly as you say. He gets absorbed into the thing. What is Hammondism? The interesting thing is he is the person being talked up as the person who is likely to have to give up his job when they have to find a big job for Boris.
Yeah, but again, I just think I really like the suggestion that they would give Boris work and pensions as a sort of punishment brief, because you could be like, oh, this is a really big spending department, Boris. It really needs somebody. But what it needs more than anything else is someone with their eye on the ball, and that would be the kind of I think that's if you think about the sort of from if you're George Osborne and you spent all this time as Chancellor, you think, I want the other guy who's up against me to have really been in the deep end of just really fine-grained minutiae, really boring things on Microsoft Excel spreadsheets. Punish him with the DWP.
The thing is there's a risk in doing that. He just says no. And is Boris more of a threat to George Osborne or David Cameron if he's on the backbenches? He can vote against tax credit cuts. He can vote against short money cuts. He can vote against whatever ill-conceived wheeze that Osborne comes up next month in the budget. I think he's far more dangerous, whereas if he's... So I think they have to give him something big, and the attraction of the Foreign Office is he's away for long periods.
He's going, bye, enjoy the air miles. There's bound to be someone that we've forgotten, isn't there? But perhaps, you know, people can tweet in with their own grades PPSs that they really, really hate.
That would be quite a fun activity next week. Tell us who you think who's the Tory minister who's done well. It can even be, you know, if a C is doing well, that's fine. And who are the people who you're expelling? IDS doesn't count because he shouldn't still be there.
Yeah, okay, we've made that a rule. That's a hard rule.
I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down to the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So, Parliament's been in recess this week, so it's inevitably been quieter than usual, but those Labour MPs who have been around have been rather morose in light of the recent polling we've had. Labour behind by an average of about 10 at the moment. There was a Comrades poll at the weekend which put them 14 points behind, which I think was the worst at any point since 2010. And of course, a lot of people say in response, well, why do we still pay attention to polls? After all, they got the general election wrong. But 2 points on that. Of course, they were wrong, but not in Labour's favour. They were sampling too few Conservative voters. And in fact, there are some polling companies who still fear that they're underestimating the Tory vote. And then, in one sense, the polls were right. They consistently showed that the Tories had a lead on best prime minister and on economic management, a position for which no party had ever lost a general election. And so the clues are all there. And like a magic eye picture, the eventual outcome, a Tory majority was merely hidden. So there's not much comfort that Labour can draw from the polls at the moment. You can't spin them. And in fact, some say, well, Jeremy Corbyn's team aren't really trying to do, because what the left ultimately care about is not winning power in the country, but winning power in the party.
But so is there a... Yeah, what if you were to ask a member of the leader's office, well, what's your plan for 2020, what would they say?
I think what they'd say is we're going to continue to campaign against austerity, and they do recognise that John McDonnell made a speech at LSE this week and was quite frank in the Q&A that followed and said, divided parties don't win elections, we need to handle the media better, we need to learn lessons. In response to a frustrated questioner, he said, yes, we do need to do more to oppose austerity. We do need to be more prominent. And they would say we've been firefighting for the last few months. Of course, some critics would say a lot of those fires were self-ignited, but they feel as if they're operating in a relentlessly hostile environment, with reference both to Labour MPs and the media. But feel they've now got some breathing space, partly thanks to the focus on the EU referendum and the Conservative split there. And obviously that's one issue on which Labour, compared to others, is remarkably united, although there are tensions, of course. And now they've got that breathing space, the onus is on them to come out with policy proposals to be much less reactive, to try and define the mood rather than respond to it. And they recognise that. And that's both an opportunity and a risk. I mean, the danger is that if the heat does go off Jeremy Corbyn for a significant period, and yet Labour doesn't make any progress, then it will be a lot harder to blame MPs, to blame the media, if the local elections go as badly as predicted.
And is there a chance, and if the local elections did go as badly as predicted and it had this fair wind, are MPs still talking to you about a 2016 attempt to get rid of him?
Few think that there'll be a challenge in the wake of May. They said it's not impossible, particularly if, worst case scenario, Sadiq Khan loses the mayoral election and Labour is pushed into third place in Scotland by the Conservatives. But most think Jeremy Corbyn will only be in the eighth month of his leadership then. He will be able to plead more time. And in some respects, it will be wrong after he won such a huge victory not to give him more time. The EU referendum is likely to be held on June the 23rd, so you'll instantly move from one campaign into another. When discussing the potential of a challenge, most MPs think 2017 is more likely, perhaps after you've had another set of they fear bad election results. And they say that the role of the trade unions in this is particularly crucial. Len McCluskey has said that Jeremy Corbyn has 2 to 3 years to make an impact, which was code really for saying if things aren't going well by that point, then Labour will need a new leader. But he himself has a battle to fight for re-election and needs to keep the left of Unite happy. And so he does balance that out by saying people should get behind Jeremy Corbyn and it's disgraceful how some Labour MPs have treated him. But MPs believe that he and other union leaders will act if Labour is clearly going to fail and is on course to lose the election, because ultimately it's in their members' interest to have a Labour government. They want a Labour government, and that MPs feel sets them aside from those on the left of the party who they feel are ultimately focused on changing Labour, on party reform, rather than on winning power to change the country.
Fab, wonderful, and we'll be back next.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Next week.
Well, let's talk about awards. We're joined by Barbara Speed, who writes about tech for us. And there's two things that have come up recently. The first, I guess, is the background. We have the Oscars next week, I think, and like end of next week, which has been bedeviled by accusations. There's no non-white person nominated in either Best Actor, Actress, Supporting Actor or Actress. Jada Pinkett Smith has talked about boycotting them. And then in our own little tiny, very much the Oscars of the news industry, the British Press Awards shortlist came out at the beginning of this week, and it was astonishing in its lack of diversity.
Although I don't like to mention one,
although one cheeky little cub reporter managed to sneak through, one S. Bush Esquire. So congratulations, Stephen. Let us demonstrate our gratitude for your nomination in Young Journalist of the Year.
Young Journalist of the Year. I'd like to thank my mum and my magazine.
By sort of pissing all over the entire concept of the press awards for 5 to 6 minutes. No, we won't do that. But I think this is a good opportunity to talk about. Okay, Barbara, first of all, let's talk about the gender ratio of it. I was really surprised, like, having previously judged these awards, and actually there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not it's about, you know, who gets put forward by the newspapers or who gets through. But there were some categories like feature writer for broadsheets where I can just think of so many women that it sort of seemed it's really hard with awards to say, well, this person shouldn't have got on and this person should have got on. But that is a category that I can think of so many women they could have picked.
Yeah, and I think the complicating factor with the press awards in particular is the note that you're kind of self-nominated by your publication or possibly by yourself. And so I think that a lot of people did raise the fact that kind of who is pushed forward within their organization might be a huge problem, because I think that we all know that most newsrooms are now, if not exactly equal, then there are a lot of women around. So I mean, I think that the final figure there was like 17% women on that shortlist, which is far lower than the number of women in the industry.
Well, but this is something that I say every time some young, eager beaver student comes to interview me about women in the media, which happens a distressing amount, which is that I think at graduate level, like whenever we advertise for a job, actually, if anything, sometimes we advertise for a job and we have a majority of female applicants. And, you know, the NS Web Desk is lady-tastic, right? Poor John Elledge.
Very sheltered.
I think feels sometimes, you know, like the real minority. But at higher levels, it's just not the same in a lot of places. You know,
True, but I think that the issue that you raised, that kind of almost categories you would expect women to do well in, they were just completely absent. So, and there was that kind of awful division of popular versus broadsheet, and the popular category was always filled with women and the broadsheet was not. And I mean, if we talk about Stephen's category, which is Young Journalist of the Year, and that can be people who've been working for a few years, but again, only one woman in that category. Yeah. So it does seem odd that in the awards, at least, the problem is stretched kind of throughout.
I'm sure there'll be people who say, well, hang on a minute, like, are you all just sitting here moaning because you don't get nominated for any awards?
Well, I'm not.
In Stephen's case, that's definitely not true. I would like to declare that I once got awarded a journalism award, which was the Games Writers Association gave me non-games writing publications Games Writer of the Year. And I think they basically, that was because Keith Stewart of The Guardian had had it like 5 years on the trot and they had to desperately cast around for someone else.
A token other person.
But yeah, but there we go.
I think the thing is, like, so I think it's a problem, one, because obviously I'm not one of those people who subscribes to the idea that the media controls how people think, but the media is responsible for packaging and deciding what is newsworthy, and winning prizes and gaining prestige is obviously a part of what keeps people in an industry. So I think it's damaging for society overall. Also, I mean, I'm not going to pretend that if I was offered the if I win the prize, I'm going to like cast it back into the ocean. But when you win an award, you want to feel like you're competing with the best of your profession. If Marina Hyde is not a political journalist, a contender for Political Journalist of the Year, then it's not really an award for the top of the profession. And whether it's the judges or the magazines, obviously the NS put me forward, and also I don't think there was a single sort of white bloke who was put forward in the end.
They put forward you and Kate Mossman in the Critic of the Year category, and she didn't get through, which I think is astonishing, because her interview with Terence Trent D'Arby was the most read thing on our website last year by an absolute street. It went totally around the world. Nearly 3 million people read it. And she's done some incredible other interviews. Apart from that, she specialises in elderly gentlemen of rock. But But I think the reason that I would make the case for having this discussion is exactly on that point you make, Stephen, which is that this is about kind of what is deemed to be serious and important. And actually, I looked, and it was really interesting looking at the, you know, the kind of categories that you get nominated for in columnists, the other kind of subjects you can't write. And there were two people who both written a column that was essentially, we mustn't get emotional about these pictures of Ellen Kurdi. We must have not an emotional response to the refugee crisis. And I thought that is the sort of apogee of serious, you know, you get serious men in the same, and it's just harder to be a serious woman of news. And that's kind of something that comes up again and again in literature about this idea about canon formation. So I'm going to be soon recording a new thing that we're doing, a history podcast about 18th century female writers. And there were just tons of them. And yet we've ended up with this warped view of...
Are you cheating on me?
I am. I'm cheating on you with two academics.
You're seeing another podcast.
Two lady academics. And then it got warped down into Daniel Defoe, you know, Samuel Richardson, Henry Fielding, as being the kind of exemplar of the rise of the novel. And that's why I think it's... The other thing I think is really annoying... sorry, this has turned into like Helen Small rant time. But is the lack of interest in the men, in the powerful men. And it's something that my sister, who works in business, said to me, is really sticks with me, which she says, the trouble so much with these diversity initiatives is it can become, okay, women, go away and solve diversity. Like, why aren't there more of you? And actually, no one ever asks the blokes. Like, you know, we had this discussion in the office yesterday about, you know, whether or not you should boycott award ceremonies when you feel that they're unfair. And I think with the Oscars, I think it's really unfair for it to be making black people boycott the Oscars. Actually, the only real change will come when, you know, Brad Pitt or someone, you know, someone of equal kind of stature, like from someone who's absolutely cast iron part of the establishment, were to do that.
Yeah. Well, also the message sent by these award nomination shortlists is basically, we don't want you there anyway. So for your response to be fine and I won't go is probably counterproductive. You need the people who are apparently wanted and lauded to say, no, this is not
Yeah, I'm not going to compete on unfair terms. I also think that probably we should have a moment to acknowledge the real talk about award ceremonies. Ben Goldacre wrote a column about this, but it's something that never really gets brought up, which is that award ceremonies, by and large, do not exist to reward excellence. They exist to generate revenue for the people running the award ceremonies. So most award ceremonies, and this happens across all industry awards, you know, journalism is not unique in this, are, you know, you pay to enter, then people are asked usually to judge for free, then people pay for a table at the award ceremony. And then that, I mean, which creates an interesting system where, you know, people feel, well, hang on a minute, why have we paid for a table 3 years in a trot and not won anything? And I think it's something that really discriminates against smaller, like in the case of the New Statesman, you know, there's the Sun will probably have three tables at this award ceremony and we would never be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So realistically, you know, there is a kind of political incentive. You know, yeah, whether or not, I'm not accusing them of doing that deliberately, but I can see that people would feel subconsciously, well, surely the Sun deserve to walk away with at least one thing.
And equally, I mean, there's another issue is that journalism can be a very good profession for women in that there's more opportunities for part-time or freelance work. But again, if you were a freelancer, the likelihood of you stomping up, what is it, £150 to enter yourself
for those awards,
awards is kind of non-existent. So actually a huge swathe of brilliant female journalism is kind of cut away there. I mean, some publications might pay for a freelancer, but if you've got your kind of big noisy men in the office and then you've got the women who send in really good stuff, I mean,
but it's also about the difference between popularity and prestige, isn't it? Because I think, you know, BuzzFeed, who by any reckoning are an incredibly successful news organization, you know, if you're a 21-year-old coming out of a journalism course, they're as likely to employ you as any newspaper, probably, I would say, in the last couple of years, considerably more likely. You know, they have really expanded the range of jobs open to people. But they're not really kind of, they're not, you know, I think they're not just not seen as sort of blue chip yet.
Yeah, well, there's this weird thing, and you'll see this when, so whenever I go for like a first meeting with an MP I haven't met before, and you do that kind of like weird first date thing, and the question I'll often get is, oh, well, who do you see as your sort of rivals? And I'll say something like, oh, Emily Ashton or Jim Waterson at BuzzFeed are very good. No, BuzzFeed?
The BuzzFeed?
The BuzzFeed. It's the BuzzFeed a thing.
Online?
And there's, and when they do something good, you'll see these people will go like, BuzzFeed's done something which is actually quite good. The word actually appears a lot in tweets about BuzzFeed's stuff.
I find that very irritating because I think it's actually bad for BuzzFeed as well, because it sort of encouraged them in this belief that they should get special claps for doing journalism, because it's kind of like, and it happens in all kinds of, you know, it happens in video games where you get stuck at people writing the piece about, no, video games can be art. It happens with, you know, tattoos, we've been stuck at like tattoos, not just for sailors. Mm-hmm. And people get stuck at these things, and then now we're definitely
if
stuck.
If I win an award, I'm getting a tattoo.
But get a tattoo of your face on your back, like Steve-O from Jackass.
Well, the one person I'm not going to go off really is myself. Yeah, I mean, like, it's much more safe than getting your kids or your wife, if you're listening to this, I love you, like, or anyone like that. Yeah.
You could get a tattoo of your Instagram feed on your back.
Yeah,
but that would be a lot of photos
Stephen
of
KB.
You. But unfortunately, but anyway, the point I was making was that people kind of do, and now people are stuck at the like, wow, BuzzFeed, not just CAD GIFs stage. Yeah. And that's kind of, it's not really good for them or anyone else. This is strayed very far from the original point.
But I mean, it is of interest that they were nominated for one thing at the Press Awards, which does, to me, just show the Press Awards are fairly stuck in the mud, really. Like, maybe we shouldn't be looking there for signs of innovation and forward thinking in the industry. But it's still annoying that of the lists that exist that show which things we think are great, that's kind of one of the only ones.
Yeah, and I think it does reveal as well that the with journalism, you know, we have this conversation all the time, and it's something that people bring up all the time with me on people on Twitter about, you know, journalism stuck in the bubble, it's all just Oxbridge graduates, it's all people that are just based in London, blah, you know, X, Y, Z about diversity stuff. And that what I've kind of come to think is that the problem is there are problems throughout the pipeline. And I don't know whether or not you agree with this. For women, I think the really big thing is how do you combine it with being a, you know, the primary parent? And we know that women still take that role on far, far more. You know, how do you get flexible working on a newspaper? You know, the lobby is particularly really tough for this because you have to be able to go and, you know, go to China with David Cameron or, you know, do on the TV stuff, do a live broadcast. And I know, you know, the broadcasters have tried to work on that, but it's still just technically really quite a tough thing to crack. On race, I think the problem starts even earlier. I mean, there were, what, four, we think, four non-white
journalists? Four or five, depending on, because obviously it's that thing where, you know, like, if depending on the picture you submit, I obviously have a fairly white-sounding name, as it were. I think The thing is depressingly, when I didn't go to journalism school myself, but I will occasionally do sort of a talk at one, and four people getting to be shortlisted for a journalism award is quite depressingly quite an impressive haul based on the people who are actually going through journalism courses, whereas 20 women out of 119 based on those rooms is...
Yeah, that's my feeling, is that the problem on race starts earlier. It starts with who's actually in the newsroom.
Yeah, it comes back to unpaid internships, which, like, you know, I mean, I couldn't have afforded to do an unpaid internship, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like, then, and that, so it's more down to the class sort of problem.
Yeah, and I think disability is exactly the same. I think that there is just, because journalism is so intensely competitive and so many people want to do it compared to the number of jobs there are, I think if you are blind or deaf or you use a wheelchair, trying to make that case, you know, The Guardian do a positive action scheme on disability, but I don't think anyone else does.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really tough. You are really at a disadvantage then.
Yeah, and when you start to have an industry that's kind of strapped for resources and needing to get the best story every time with the least amount of investment, it's not a surprise that those things fall by the wayside. I mean, that's one of the big dangers of the kind of pressures facing it now.
Yeah. Well, that was depressing.
We'll get better.
But on a happy note, I am shortlisted for an award.
Well, on that note, thank you very much, Barbara, for joining us.
And welcome to You Ask Us. This week we've been asked to pick not necessarily some MPs to watch who we think will lead their parties, but just ones who are interesting, who we think, you know, perhaps are ones you've heard of, perhaps not, who are kind of, let's say, I don't know, three MPs. They can be one from each party, or they can be from the same party, or...
Three MPs. Do you know what? I was surprisingly impressed by Gavin Barwell. There's somebody who probably listeners might not have heard of. He was PPS to Michael Gove at Education. He came on to do this discussion. And I was just struck by how he had thought about what the discussion was. It was about, and actually how he could get Tory messages across. Now, you know, that's a sort of seems like a really budget thing to applaud someone for. But, you know, fundamentally, that is your job as a politician, is to think about the opportunity you have and the opportunity to deliver your messages in that slot. And he was really interesting on Gove about, you know, he said, you know, he conceded the fact that Gove had tried to do too much education, but said, you know, that's because he's aware, you know, his time's really short. And I thought, well, this is somebody who's acknowledged the criticisms, who's not trying to give me a kind of total pravda, but has kind of thought about how to present this in a way that, you know, will appeal to Tory voters. So I was impressed with him. I have a soft spot for Jess Phillips because she is just undaunted in the way that she says things, and I think she adds to the gaiety of the nation in the sense that her quotes are always eye-catching. You know, you read it, you know, it just sounds like your mate in the pub who is, you know, who's got an opinion on everything, and I find that really attractive. Who else is my third one? You're looking at me like I'm going to go, and my third one is Stephen Bush MP, who I think is a little known. No, you go on, you can pick, you pick a couple, and I'll think of my third one.
Johnny Mercer. The relatively newly elected Tory MP in Plymouth, who's thoughtful and interesting, has done some sort of interesting interventions.
He's a former soldier. I did a panel with him and Paddy Ashdown and Charlie Faulkner. And again, he's somebody who he stood up and made a speech against tax credits. So he's already marked himself out as being kind of independent minded. But yeah, okay, good choice.
And this maybe not be so much one to watch because obviously there's very far little you can go in the Lord, but my other interesting person is, I think, Charlie Faulkner, who's having this quite surprising second political life.
He seems to be quite enjoying him. Every time I see him, he looks like he's really chipper.
Yeah, then you would not have, because he is literally the last Blairite left in the Shadow Cabinet. You wouldn't have picked Charlie Faulkner as the final survivor of the New Labour era, and you also would have expected him to be a continually awkward, not very effective presence. But he's actually managing to somehow balance. He hasn't shredded anything he believes in publicly. He's not, you know, he has managed to get to a position where he is a relatively thriving and stable member of Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet, which I think is an impressive feat of political resilience.
I might pick Sarah Wollaston then, and I know that's a kind of classic again. I guess we're going down very much down the path of independent-minded backbenchers, but chairman of the House Select Committee, she's been very interesting on the sugar tax. I don't agree with her on the doctors, but she's been very interesting on that too. And she is somebody who I think, you know, has a good grasp of the issues on which she speaks and is always interesting.
And actually, my final one, I'm going to go with Heidi Alexander, who I know I've tipped for other things before on this podcast, but you know, really Jeremy Corbyn's star signing, not of his politics, but someone who had, you know, we complain about Jeremy Corbyn treating women as an afterthought, which he does, but he is a light years ahead of Ed Miliband, who had plenty of decent women who were inexplicably left in the second tier, of whom Heidi Alexander is one. She's been a phenomenal shadow health secretary. She's really got Jeremy Hunt on the run, and the number of urgent questions, commons interventions, you know, next time you're off sick and you're watching, you know, you should watch the Parliament Channel, watch Heidi Alexander in full flow. She's a really impressive operator.
I might give a small shout out actually to Chris Bryant as well, who is again having a second kind of act of his career. He's kind of leader of the kind of Just Make It Work faction. Again, he doesn't share Jeremy Corbyn's politics, but he's in there, he's getting stuck in. Actually, very much like John Ashworth is as well, you know, really actually just sticking it to the Tories quite effectively.
And Chris Bryant versus Chris Grayling, I would say it's one of the best clashes, but that would imply a level of even-handedness. And it's just...
He's already dead.
Yeah, if you wanted to show a new MP here's how to perform in the Commons, regardless of you know, their own politics, you go, well, look, watch Chris Grayling, who, you know, timing is perfect, lines are perfect, mastery of the House... The worst thing is actually when Chris Grayling's speechwriters have written him a good line and he's still... The delivery is so bad, and whereas, yeah, I think my favourite was when Chris Bryant talking about the trade union bill said, well, under the rules for ballot thresholds, most of the MPs here wouldn't be here, including the honourable gentleman. And you're just like, oh, I can see the punch coming, Grayling can see the punch coming, but there's nowhere for him to go.
Well, there we go. We've been nice about people for a change. Isn't that lovely?
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.